So class number three, ancient wisdom for modern life. And you've been at all so far. Yep, that's, and Jinx as well. And Abaddon, welcome back. Like I said, you'll be able to catch up very easily. So today we're looking at, why is it that loving someone can easily turn to hate, a favourite song you can then get sick of, you know, things that you really aspire to or loved, you know, back in the day, now you're just totally over it. So what's this thing that happens, this obsession and then the dislike? And what is it that, you know, that's happening of this things that we think will bring us happiness or satisfaction? How come they bring so many complications? What's going on here? So basically what it's about in tonight's class, we're looking at what's called inappropriate attention. So that's a very dry way of saying the kind of attention or relationship we have with things and people and events, our hopes and our fears, all of our unconscious expectations, projections, everything that's going on there. And it comes under the term of inappropriate attention, which is actually very skillful because it shows that the attention is there, but it's distorted. And if it's distorted, there is something we can do about it. Doesn't mean that we're broken and doomed. So the inappropriate attention, we can have the rose-colored glasses, or we can have the dark glasses of doom and gloom. Either way, they're distorting reality. They're not seeing reality clearly or in focus. And because they're distorted, we'll see how come that causes us suffering. And then how to develop a mind of equanimity or a mind at ease that doesn't go up and down like a yo-yo like that. Before we kind of do our little setting up motivation, were there any questions or comments about last week's worksheets? Anything of note? Anything that was difficult? Anything that was easy? Leanne, I see you did them, which is awesome. Does it make a difference just having them in mind? Yeah, so when I get really slack, I may not start my day if I don't have to get up early, then I don't necessarily start it well. But if I have to get up early for class, then I start it well. And it's thanks to having to do a class that I've got any discipline at all. But it makes all the difference. Okay, anything at all? Anything that you got stuck on or wondered about? It is murky, and actually it's a very murky thing, because just sorting out between, even though we have an impetus to blame and then we don't want to blame, but like how much is from my side, how much is from their side, and what's going on. But that's actually what we're going to look at tonight, because it is so murky. It's something that we intuitively grasp. It's actually something that we're very tangled about, and that's why our relationships are so complicated. Behave better and, discipline your behaviour a bit.
I still feel negative.
It is an incremental thing. Yeah. So the minimum that we have to do is change our behaviour, because it's our behaviour that contributes to the situation and keeps it going.
Yeah.
So often what happens, of course, is we change our behaviour, we zip our lip, we don't say the thing. The moment is gone and we think, oh, it's fixed.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's not fixed.
Yeah.
It's not fixed up. There's still all the potential there.
Yeah.
So that's actually, again, today's topics of what do we do, and how we can have a strategy, because we just want a really quick fix, but this isn't a quick fix. There are, and I like to find the easy way to do everything. And I've found that you just nibble away at the edges, and there's a lot that we can do that starts working towards changing things. Just a little bit here and a little bit there, changing our attitude. So I'm very glad you brought those both up, because hopefully by the end of the night you'll have some answers. So let's just set our motivation then. So first adjusting our posture, then we'll adjust our mind. So for the posture, straighten your spine, but do so in a relaxed kind of manner. And imagine that you have that thread of light running through your body from the base of your spine up through your body and out your crown, and feel you being supported by your crown. That thread of light is naturally straight, luminous, supple, light. And the rest of your body naturally aligns around it. You should find that your head just tilts slightly forward. Make sure you pull the chin back, that your chin isn't jutting outwards. Relax the jaw, put a slight smile on your lips. Have your eyes slightly open so some light comes in. Release any tension from the temples, the frown lines, the forehead. Tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. And then let your shoulders drop and let any tension held in the neck and the shoulders, just let it go, let it release. Make sure that you feel comfortable. Let your body relax around your straight spine. And then just let the issues of the day, of the week, these various homework questions we've been talking about, let them come to the fore of your consciousness. They're where we begin, our current day-to-day issues. And we can recognize how they're like the tip of the iceberg of the whole profound problem of existence. How do we live our life? What causes happiness? What causes suffering? So we can let our current issues lead us to these really big questions. And we can also recognize that it's not just us that has these really big questions, but everybody does, even if they're not conscious. We still yearn to make our life meaningful. We still yearn for happiness and safety. And yet so few of us have an opportunity to do anything about it. So we can adjust our motivation that we're here for our own benefit and also for the benefit of all others who are just like us, as if they were ourselves. And that by doing this inner work and investigation, developing our good qualities, that this can have a beneficial effect that flows outwards to reach every single living being, that we can actually create a more peaceful and harmonious world by starting right here with ourselves. And our ultimate goal, we don't have to put any limit on it. We can think we don't have to stop until we are liberated from suffering and we've brought everyone along with us to a state of lasting peace and happiness. So with this motivation then, you can gently bring your focus back to the room and let's have a look at this thing called inappropriate attention. And actually, so a little something from Lama Yeshe, Wisdom Energy, this article, a teaching on these six delusions, the six factors that cause delusions to arise. So Lama Yeshe has been going through each of these six, and this is the third one. And so this is his little story about inappropriate attention. So he says, you have a boyfriend, for example, with whom you're obsessed. You find his every movement and gesture interesting. The way he walks, what he says, what he does, it all seems good to you. Even when he does something incredibly bad, for you it becomes a source of pleasure. You're concentrating so much on his attractive qualities that his negative aspects are totally obscured. That's about my entire high school life right there. Extreme. Okay. The mind works in such a way, however, that if one day he says something particularly unpleasant to you, your attitude begins to change. You think, oh, he's not nice at all. Your mind concentrates on this thought, not nice, not nice, not nice. And soon everything about him appears repulsive. There's nothing about him anymore that's pleasing to you. You can see this happen, can't you? It's incredible how the deluded mind works. First, something that appears completely positive, and then it changes to its opposite. But I say it's totally impossible for any object, any sentient being, to be completely positive or completely negative. Everything has both positive and negative energy. It's only the obsessed mind that sees things in terms of black and white. There is a certain saying I heard in the West, you hear what you want to hear. This is a very accurate psychological statement and a very good Dharma point. It emphasizes the truth of what we've been discussing. So we see what we want to see, or probably a little more nuanced, we see what we either want or what we're frightened of. We see with the obsessed mind. And so that's what inappropriate attention is. So how it actually happens, you know, we've talked about last week the seed and the object. So we have the seed or that potential for an experience, a potential for a disturbing emotion, a potential for a virtuous state of mind, countless seeds, impossible to tell how many we have. We don't really know the measure of how many seeds or potentials we have in our mind. Then we have all the infinite objects out there, the objects of attachment, the objects of aversion. Now, even there, I put champagne and gorgeous high heels up because to me they're objects of attachment, but I only just realised they could actually be objects of aversion to some people. Like high heels are often an object of aversion, not of attachment at all. So right there, there's a key in that. So we have our objects, all the various things that trigger us, people, situations, things. But so far, we don't yet have a delusion. We just have almost everything there. But what kicks it off is attention. So in terms of an object that we find pleasing, our attention towards it builds it up. We look at it through rose-colored glasses. Now, this happens with me with high heels. We go, oh, beautiful, wonderful high heels. Wear them in the shop. Yeah, not so sure if they're comfortable. Doesn't matter. We've all had that one, haven't we? Then we get them home, and, of course, then within half an hour, if you actually have to walk to the place where you're going out and having the party, by the time you get there, your feet are in agony. So that's the rose-coloured glasses attention. And because of that distortion, the distorted attention, then we get the delusion. So it's only when inappropriate attention arises that we, you know, we panic or we get overexcited, that a disturbance sets into our mind and a delusion arises. So this is kind of good news in a way, because how many seeds do we have? We don't know. How many objects are there out there? Infinite. Can't control either of those very much. The seeds, that's a long-term proposition to get rid of them all. The objects, it's impossible to control everyone and everything. But our attention, that we can definitely control. And if we can control that, then a delusion won't arise. So we have these three distortions, and they happen with both desirous attachment and with aversion and hatred. The three main distortions, we exaggerate. So we overestimate either the good qualities of something. You know, we're so involved in the anticipation. We're thinking of all the good things, and we really build them up much more than what they are. We project aspects that are not there. So one of the things, like in job interviews, we're trained in a job interview to project confidence, aren't we? Because there is this association that if you're confident, you must be good at what you do. And as we know in real life, that's not true. Actually, confident people can be crap at what they do. And people that are really skilled may be quite humble and go, you know. So, but we project. If someone is confident, we think they're good. If someone's in a suit, we think they're legit, mostly. That's how people get scammed. One thing that I learned about job interviews, that if you have good teeth, you're much more likely to get the job than if you have bad teeth. So I thought, oh, well, there's me gone. So this is one of those things that people, it's a subliminal thing, and people associate good qualities with good teeth and dodgy qualities with dodgy teeth. So if you come like Latvia is my mother's side of the family comes from Latvia. All of Latvia has bad teeth. So that's the projection. That's a distortion. And there are many that are there. Or we're biased. So we're just one-sided. Like when you have the infatuation with someone, all you can see is their good qualities. And your friends might say to you, oh, God, how can you go out with them? And you just can't hear it. You say, no, they're brilliant. And then, you know, then they say the nasty thing to you. And then you just like Lamy Eshi was saying, then you start dwelling on, oh, how could they say that to me? Maybe they're, and then your mind goes off on the other track, all of the things. And then you become really biased the other way. You start picking out every single bad thing about them. With, say, for instance, with attachment, that bias, especially because if we don't yet have the thing, we're thinking about all the qualities and how we're going to get it. And our mind doesn't like to think about any drawbacks. This will happen, Bruce, when you're house hunting. You get really excited about, oh, yeah, this could be the one. But as we know, the moment we get into whatever house we're in, that day is when we discover all the flaws about it. And why? Because we have this bias, this partiality, and it catches us up. So these three distortions, exaggerations, projections, and the bias, the one-sidedness, because we believe them, then it results in a full-blown delusion of either attachment or hatred. So why do we believe in them? How come do we get caught out? Why do we get stuck? And what's driving this is the reifying view. And I think of it as a tyranny. It's the tyranny of the reifying view. So the reifying view is thinking that it's from the object out there. It's from the thing in itself out there. The thing out there causes my experience, causes my happiness or causes my unhappiness. So that's this kind of, it's quite an extreme view. So we think the object out there rather than our own capacity for pleasure, for instance, is the cause of our pleasure. So the reason I put up here this picture of a boat going down the river near you know, the Eiffel Tower in Paris and some champagne was because years ago I actually went on a cruise and, you know, so you think that cruise is going to be the cause of my pleasure, all of my happiness. You think that so much that you're willing to pay quite a bit of money to have the experience. And so what I found about that cruise was that even though me and everybody else on the boat was experiencing the same, going through the same things, having the same amazing food, the same incredible room service, like every morning there'd be the knock on the door and they'd go, good morning, Miss Miffy. And then they'd come in with the tray of the croissants and the coffee and the orange juice and I'd try and take it out of their hand. They go, no, Miss Miffy, please sit down. And they make me sit down, then they put it all on the table and I couldn't do anything. Like, I'm just like, oh, my God, this is so over the top. So I tried to be really friendly with everybody and, you know, and then, of course, I was there on the cruise by myself. And so I had to talk to other people because you'd have to sit at a table with other people. That was the worst bit about it. But anyway, so, you know, I try and be friendly with everybody. And so you'd be having all of this incredible treatment, food, course after course, little bits of sorbet in between each course as a palate cleanser, like all this stuff I had no idea about. And yet the woman next to me said, when the third delicious course came out, oh, you know, this is so delicious. Tomorrow's meal's going to be a real disappointment. So that blew my mind because it just became crystal clear to me that you can have like the pinnacle of this human indulgent experience, and if you don't have the capacity for happiness, you can find something wrong in it. And so she was not satisfied. She actually couldn't even enjoy the evening because all she could think about was how tomorrow wasn't going to measure up. So this is the tyranny of the reifying view, that if you think your happiness comes from out there, you're going to be constantly wanting more and reliant on it and panicking when it's not there and comparing. And actually, why do we enjoy ourselves anyway? It's nothing to do with the thing out there. It's our capacity for enjoyment. It's our ability to enjoy ourselves that's the key, not the thing out there. So we kind of ascribe the, you know, the goodness or the badness of a thing to the thing out there itself. And actually, it's a big mistake. So when you hear about the Buddhist concept of selflessness, that's what they're talking about, that the object itself isn't inherently good or bad. So Karl Marx talked about commodity fetishism, which I love the term. Because it is fetishism. We think, you know, a cruise and champagne and everything is the pinnacle. So we impute all these characteristics that are not there in the object, but we impute them onto the object. So I'll tell you another story to do with the whole cruise experience. I heard a couple of years ago, you know, those big cruises where they on the ocean, you know, several thousand people on the ship. And they have everything, don't they? They have like 10 restaurants and rides and slides and six swimming pools and like everything is there. Your bed is made for you. All your food is prepared. Every single day you've got all these activities. And for many people, it is the pinnacle of what you can do as a human being in terms of entertainment. And yet this lady, actually, mother in a family, committed suicide on the boat. She threw herself off the boat into the ocean. So everyone's like, how could that happen? But actually, after my experience of being on a cruise and seeing how dissatisfied people were, I could see how you could have a moment of despair and angst, because here you are, the pinnacle of the experience, of a hedonistic experience, and you're not happy. And if that confronts you, of course, I think actually being suicidal is a legit response. That is probably a real insight. But instead of thinking maybe all of these external things isn't the way, maybe there's something else, she didn't have anywhere to go with it. So went to the extreme of suicide. So that is the tyranny of the reifying view, that if we actually think our happiness comes from out there, when it doesn't come from out there, then we can even get suicidal. So how do we start removing that tyranny? Is by remembering that how it appears is not how it exists. How it appears, brilliant and perfect and lovely, is not how it exists. Or on the other side of things, how it appears horrible, despicable, I don't like one single good thing about it, that also is not how it exists. And the key to loosening our mind up is to recognize the appearance and go, okay, that person to me seems absolutely abhorrent. That's the appearance to me, but it's not how they exist. So it starts loosening our mind up a bit. So, I mean, even with champagne, to some people, champagne is something that, you know, is quite delicious, and the bubbles and the, you know, they have ads about it, Schweppervescence, don't they? The little bubbles that trigger our reifying view. But I'm sure there are many people in the world that have had their first bad experience with champagne. You know, their first experience with champagne was a terrible hangover and they just spewed their guts out and then just went, how on earth can you like something like that? You know, it's disgusting. And, of course, if you're in a bad mood, if you're going through a really terrible time, many times you can do something that you normally would like and it has no joy in it. You know, you go to the movies and you can't concentrate on the movie, you still feel terrible. You have your favourite food and it's tasteless. So, again, that's a key. It reveals something to us. So there's a quote from Buddhism for Dummies here. To recover from addiction, alcoholics must first remove the illusion that intoxication is happiness. In reality, alcohol brings misery to themselves and others. Free yourself from the illusion that external objects are a true source of happiness. Break the addiction to the world of ephemeral pleasures by looking within, by being content with less. So the reifying view is something that we'll come back to again and again, but it is the driver of all of our delusions. Questions, comments before we go on to some examples? Have you ever been on a cruise?
Yes.
Yep. How was it? Was it like that? Or
not really for me.
Was it for you?
Like that.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't like it. And I thought, I must be really spoiled in my life because I can go out for nice food whenever I want when I'm at home. Whereas some people that I met on there, they never had their bed made for them. They worked full-time jobs and looked after lots of kids. And so for them, it was like a real...
It was an actual holiday, so yes, yeah. But even then, like, you know, you like the cruise because you got to have family time.
Yeah, I did like that.
But there are some cruises where even the ad on the telly, it says no casinos, no kids.
Yeah.
It's a different sort of cruise. So right there, if it was in the thing in itself, then everybody would love it.
Yeah.
But it's not. There's all different types, isn't there? So, again, it can't be in the thing of it in itself. What, you went on a cruise too? Yeah, so how was yours?
Okay.
So great to spend the time and then after a week you're done. Yes. Yes, so that's like the slow shifting over. And probably if it, you know, at the beginning of COVID there was one ship where they got stuck on the ship for months. So you really would have wanted to like your flatmates. Because, yes. It's a particular form of like a very rarefied hell, isn't it? You have everything laid on and yet you cannot escape anybody. So let's have a look how it works. The mind of attachment. Okay. So we have the rose-colored glasses. For the exaggeration, one of the exaggerations that we think, you know, people wanting a family and expecting family life to bring a sense of fulfillment and meaning, and that it comes from out there, from the family. And just like you're saying, yes, for a little while, but if you had to spend 24/7 with your family for more than a week, it's too much. So the exaggeration is in the complete fulfillment or in the lasting fulfillment. Because surely a family life brings fulfillment, but it changes, doesn't it? So then kids grow up and leave, and many people experience great suffering, the empty nester syndrome. So if you've relied on that through this kind of mind of exaggeration, it's the exaggeration that brings the suffering. Or my child's qualities are better than any other child's qualities. So I was just thinking of all those countless things that you see about like soccer mums, you know, of when it's my child, it's different. So there is definitely an exaggeration there that we care more about me and mine than other people, than the others. Yet to the others, that's their most important. Their qualities are the best. Then we have projection. So here's one. We project qualities that aren't there. So when someone's pretty, we also, without even knowing it, expect them to be good and kind. And there are countless movies and books made with this where it turns out that they're not, because there's like this cognitive dissonance that happens. We have this projection. And I remember just reading an article about Naomi Campbell, the supermodel, throwing a tantrum on a plane, and it made the BBC news. I'm like, why? How many people throw a tantrum on a plane all the time? The supermodel, the beautiful one, how can this be? To be beautiful and to act in an ugly way. So that's the mind of attachment, having this projection on there. There's another one, you know, he or she is charismatic. They're exciting, they're charismatic, so therefore they have all these other good qualities. They're a safe person to be with. They won't cheat me. They'll look after me well. So many assumptions, expectations associated with just one type of quality, we think all the rest comes along with it. And in terms of things like a relationship or a house or a job, we like it, we have an idea about it, we think it'll bring all of this stuff with it. We think it'll bring in particular security. So there's a big projection there, because as we know, the moment you actually own a house, it doesn't bring security. It brings a whole lot of pressure and worry and maintenance and expense and what if it burns down and, you know, all of this. So the projection there is this wonderful fantasy of anticipation that we play out. And the thing about attachment that's so tricky is that while that fantasy is playing out, it all seems really quite okay. And actually it's quite, anticipation is a nice thought. We only see the flip side of attachment later on, when it changes after the week with the family, not at the beginning, but it's at the end, or after overeating, like the too much food. So it's a very sneaky thing. It sneaks up on us. There is a time lag. And biased, so we see all the qualities and we ignore the faults. So the seeing all the qualities and ignoring the faults, I mean, I do this with food. Yummy, 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 yummy. Forget about, okay, there is a limit to how much you can eat. Or maybe something disagrees with me, like I just can't eat bread, but I don't want to know that whilst I'm eating the bread. So, you know, I think I'm relatively intelligent. Why does this happen to me over and over and over again? Because the mind of attachment, it colours everything, regardless if you have intelligence or not, because it's much deeper than an intellectual thing. It's really deep into our instincts. Our mind of attachment is very biased, that if our friends or our family act badly, we always make excuses and stuff. But if somebody else does down the road, it's like, no, full force of the law on them. Thank you very much. Enjoy now, ignore the consequences. So, I mean, I've kind of painted a picture here. Does it make sense? Can you see how it's not the object that is the problem? It's this distorted mind. It's the rose-colored glasses that actually is the problem that brings the suffering. So I have just a little thing from Yangtze Rinpoche. This is a book called Practicing the Path, and it's a really good overview of Buddhist teachings, especially for beginners. And so just talking about the various delusions, so the mind of attachment, for instance. So the general nature of delusions, their general nature, is that they interrupt our peaceful state of mind and create disturbance. The deluded mind of attachment superimposes qualities onto its object and then generates clinging and grasping toward that object based on that projection. attachment is like a lasso that binds us to cyclic existence. Conventionally, it is, of course, true that there are things that can be said to be relatively beautiful or unattractive, pleasant or unpleasant, good or bad. But the mind of attachment sees a solid, concrete, beautiful object that exists in this way from the side of the object itself. And this is the main mistake. So we think it's the actual thing that's doing it. From the side of the object itself, that's the reifying view right there. And the same thing happens with the mind of hatred. So he's talking here about the mind of anger arises in relation to those whom we have labeled the enemy, in relation to that which we've labeled bad, or in relation to that which we consider unpleasant. The mind of anger is aggressive and violent. The mind that wishes ill will or harm on others is suffused with anger. But the mind of anger is not necessarily pervaded by the wish to harm. The mind of vengeance and the mind that holds a grudge are also permeated by anger. Anger can arise as a result of incorrect logic and reasoning. Anger can arise out of ignorance or without any logical reason at all. So he's kind of making a distinction here between anger and hatred. So anger is just that kind of general, dislike, aversion. It's violent and it's aggressive. Hatred then becomes much more focused, much more retaliatory. So the mind of hatred, we exaggerate. So the exaggeration, one person yells at us once and in our mind we think the yelling person. They're tarnished with that for the whole time. And in our mind, we think, I bet they yell all the time. I bet they yell like that at everybody. You know, I bet they come out of their mother's womb yelling and they yelled at their cats and their dogs. And in our mind, that's who they are. And actually, it might have been the only time that they yelled like the whole time. And it was just at us and we just happened to be there. Or we think yelling at someone, how they, you know, no one does that to me. That is totally unacceptable. So in that, we might think, yeah, fair enough, no one should be yelling and swearing at us. But if we start to look below the surface, what if there's someone with Tourette's, you know? What if they're deaf and they're not sure how much volume's coming out? Or like me, who has, this is my inside voice. You know, things come out really blunt and people go, why are you yelling? I'm like, I'm not yelling. It's just normal. So we exaggerate what's happening. And actually, sometimes we have to yell. Like if someone's about to do something really stupid, like a kid run out onto the road, you're not going to go, darling. You just go, hey, get their attention. Might I even scare them? So the mind of hatred exaggerates this kind of characteristic and makes it much, much worse than it is. And especially when people do things, really bad things, we exaggerate too. So in the media, a lot of times, especially if children do really destructive activities, they're painted as being monsters or evil, something other than normal children. And that's a real exaggeration, and it's kind of a way of trying to protect our own psyche. Then we have the projection. So someone gives us some kind of criticism or points out a fault, we add more to it. So they might have said, oh, you did this wrong. That's actually a fact. But that's not what we hear. What we hear is, you are a loser. We project so much more on. We put a value judgment. I did something wrong, therefore I am bad. I am wrong. I'm no good. So, or we think that someone's pointed it out to be mean to us. We assume that because the because we don't like having a mistake pointed out, we think that it's been pointed out to make us unhappy. Whereas someone might have just wanted to save you some bother. there is so much unhappiness that comes from that of taking things personally. Also, people act badly, and in our mind, we think they should know better. And so, therefore, we get really upset. But if we find out, for instance, that maybe they were having a psychotic episode, maybe they were under the effect of drugs or alcohol or anesthetic, and all of these inappropriate things came out of their mouth, then we see how, even though at first we think people should know better, no one acts badly because they've got it together in their mind, do they? They act badly because they don't have it together. So they actually don't know better. They are overwhelmed by their own negativity. And the other thing is that we assume that if someone is aggressive to us, that they are aggressive all the time. So there's a lot of that happens almost instantaneously, the moment someone speaks just even slightly roughly to us. And then we have the bias. So when someone is acting really aggressive, maliciously, badly, they're being racist or sexist, we can't see beyond that. We can't see the hurt and the fear underneath that. We forget that they're probably not like that to those that they love and care for. They're probably kind to somebody else, it's just not us. And the bias also is about us. We forget that, hang on a second, we also have yelled at others and behaved really badly too. We're just going la 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 la. I can't remember that bit. So I remember, when Trump was the president and there was some kind of demonstration and a white supremacist drove their car into the crowd and ran over some people. And I remember Trump saying something about, but there were many fine people there. And so that really got a section of society's heckles up, but again, the other section of society, was kind of like a subliminal call out to his people. So that's the bias that you have. You justify and you stand up for your people, me and mine, and the others are no good. So there's this incredible bias, and it's all to do with how people treat us, whether we think they're ours or not. So this is how it happens. We find someone unattractive or we don't like them, but then we exaggerate their imperfections. Then we impute false attributes onto them and generate all kinds of reasons why they're horrible. And then we dwell on these, continually reviewing those reasons. And then we become unable to see any positive aspect at all, thus stopping any chance of a remedy. And then we build up a powerful and destructive anger. So it escalates from just, if we don't pay any notice to what's happening, from just finding something unpleasant, the mind of inappropriate attention, in this case hatred, escalates until suddenly we've got this really destructive state of mind. No one sets out to be full of hatred, to be malicious, and yet it happens all by itself. How? By this distorted mind. So they're the two main ones, and they're the ones that we can notice. So at least with hatred, it's pretty obvious when we are filled with hatred or where someone else is. With attachment, it's far trickier because we only notice when attachment changes. When the nice experience changes, we're sick of it, it changes, and then we notice there's a problem. But all the rest of the time, attachment's quite enjoyable. But that's why we get sick of something. That's why we get sick of, like, I loved eating sausages and dolmades. So I ate sausages and dolmades for 4 months straight. So you can imagine what happened. It's like 6 years later, I finally opened my next can of dolmades. So, you know, the mind of attachment, it just takes a while and then it flips to its opposite. cherry picking, yes. You ate as many cherries as...
I'm back to enjoying
it. Yeah. And that way we really ruin things for ourselves, yeah, isn't it? Well, and it's not that the cherries changed.
What?
It's not in the cherries, is it?
No.
It's our real extreme distorted, yeah. Okay, so let's do a little reflection then. So just to try and pinpoint how inappropriate attention happens, how it arises. So we can do this inner investigation. Being a Buddhist actually means being an inner person, an inner being, investigating what's going on in our mind. So in your day-to-day life, do you pay attention more to the negative aspects of a situation or the positive ones? What's your natural way of responding to a new situation or your natural way of responding when things change? Easier to pay attention to the negative aspects or the positive ones? Do you find yourself being quite quick to jump to conclusions? Do you notice yourself being judgmental? And how much do you look at a situation only in terms of how they affect you or those that you're attached to that matter to you? And how much are you able to see the bigger picture, incorporating other people's needs and concerns? How much time do you spend dwelling on the negative aspects of people or situations? Is it difficult to stop? How easily do you get obsessed about objects or people? Do you let your mind run on, holding tighter and tighter to the object? What steps can we take to remedy these tendencies? At the very least, make a determination, remembering how something appears, how we first experience it, is not the way it exists. What kind of glasses are we looking through? And you can gently bring your focus back to the room. So there's a summary here from Lama Yeshe. Seeing some kind of desirable object then always involves an overestimation. Its good aspects are emphasized so much that you lose all judgment about it. Simultaneously, you view that object as if it were somehow self-existent. You conceive of it as something permanent, existing self-sufficiently the way it appears to you. You fail to see that the way it appears is actually a function of your own projections. Instead, you think that these exaggerated qualities come from the object itself, rather than being what you projected onto the object from your own side. You do not see what has happened. This deluded projection covering the object is much thicker than makeup. Impermanent things are viewed as permanent. Objects created by the nature of suffering are thought of as the causes of happiness. And although all things lack true independent self-existence, they are conceived of as having such self-existence. Lama Tsongkhapa defined this process as holding on to something that has nothing to do with reality. It's completely unrelated to the way things actually exist. You grasp onto something, perceiving and believing it to exist in a certain way, and as a result, your delusions grow. So this way that we grasp onto things that has nothing to do with reality. So this is because we have these misconceptions about the nature of things. And because we labor under these misconceptions, this is why we suffer. So this teaching comes from the first of the Four Noble Truths, and it's really to do with how we look for lasting happiness, which is nothing wrong with that, but we look for it where it cannot be found. Clearly it can't be found in the cruise, even though we've spent a lot of money investigating that, haven't we? So one of the misconceptions that we have, and it's this misconception that brings suffering, is we just assume that things and people and relationships don't change. We just assume they don't. This isn't an intellectually held view. This is just a deep assumption that we have. We forget about the natural principle of atrophy or disintegration, that things naturally will wear out. We know we're not immortal, and yet we're shocked when someone dies. So I remember when David Bowie died, it's like, David Bowie died. How can this happen? and like Bruce, you know, when Garold died and you said, but he was just here last week. I thought, that's right. We know and yet we don't know. And it's because we have this misconception. It's very deep within us, grasping at permanence. And it's the grasping at permanence that brings the suffering because we get the shock. Whereas if we recognize that things will naturally decay and break, if we take the other way, if we know, for instance, that the flowers will eventually, you know, rot and fade away, we know that's going to happen, so then we don't suffer. We also expect that things and people and events and families and relationships and jobs and careers will bring us lasting happiness. We expect the happiness that they bring to be true, real, lasting happiness. And yet, no matter how much we acquire, we're still dissatisfied. And the moment we finish one cruise, we want to go on another cruise. And, you know, we're so busy, we just want a break, and then we get into lockdown, and then it's like, oh, I'm so sick of being locked in, I just want to get out there again. Then we get out there and we go, oh, my God, it's all so busy, I just want to go home. So this is what happens when we're chasing our happiness out there, those things that constantly change. The happiness cannot last. And yet we put so much of our effort and energy into that and get so disappointed when it doesn't pan out. So I remember having an enormous argument with my mother as a child, wanting a Paddington bear. And I just, because everybody else had one, I wanted one as well. And it just brought so much discord and suffering to the family. And so finally, because that was super expensive, we didn't have any money, finally they managed to somehow get enough money to get this, you know, branded name thing, Paddington Bear. So how much did I love it for? Like maybe I certainly don't love it now, do I? It didn't bring me lasting happiness. So those things, it's so intense when you're a kid, isn't it? It's life and death. You want that thing. And now we look at that thing and go, well, that's stupid. But we do exactly the same thing now with our current obsessions. So we have this longing for lasting happiness. There's nothing wrong with that. But where the suffering comes is where we think we can find it from that object out there. And then we're continuously disappointed, betrayed. So often we might make the mistake and think, oh, therefore I'm going to give up on lasting happiness. No, that's a big mistake. Don't go all bland and nihilistic on that. We just got to look for where it can be found. And that's within our capacity for happiness, for actually developing a calm, peaceful state of mind. We have an assumption that things are pure and perfect. How do I know we have this assumption? Because when you get a contraption, a photocopier, a car, a mix master, whatever it is, we say, but it should work. Right there, that's our assumption. We think that it should be pure and perfect. It should work. And it's so frustrating when they don't. So actually, we're looking for the perfect in things that are by nature imperfect. Why are they by nature imperfect? Because all of their components will naturally wear out and break, because they're invented by human beings that are imperfect. So they're going to have unforeseen consequences like pollution or, you know, parts wear out. And yet we expect everything to work. Our gadgets, our computers, our politics. We expect our politics and our politicians to be perfect, and yet they're human beings. If our politicians were Buddhas, then the political system would work. So even though we may not intellectually think that our partner, whoever we're in a relationship with, is perfect, we do expect them to be perfect, because the one time that they do something that's not right, it's like, how very dare they? The last one is a little trickier, that things have a real or findable essence. So, you know, that we think we're our body, but that's a misconception. When we actually start looking at, am I my body or not? We start talking about my body, even though we think this is me, but somehow we think we're the possessor of me. When we think that we are our body, for instance, then if something happens to our body, like we lose a leg or you have to have your breasts amputated or whatever it is, you can have a real crisis of, who am I? What's happening to me? Huge amount of suffering comes from that. But actually, when we look at our bodies are actually an accumulation of atoms and water and all sorts of things, very changeable. Even, you know, even when we die, it's not that our body just disappears. All those atoms still continue. The atoms don't die. the collection uncollects. And who we are as a person, a personality, actually is a collection of reactions to circumstances. So most of the time we're just reactive. We're just going on autopilot. We just react according to what our habits are. And most of who we are is how we've been brought up, what education we've had, whether we're a man, whether we're a woman, whether we're white, whether we're Asian, whether we're black, whether we're short and tall, all of those things create who we are. And then we think, this is me. And then this, we may not think this is a problem or a misconception, but when this is threatened or when it changes, then there's a huge crisis that happens. And there's a lot of conflict that happens in the world from this as well. Even just how we identify with our body, that if we lose our looks, then we start feeling bad about ourselves. Instead of thinking, yay, I'm still alive, I can still take the essence of this human life, I can still save the planet, we're just like, oh, I'm old and fat. You know, it's terrible, isn't it? But that comes from grasping and thinking, this is me, I have this real findable essence. So these four main things, we labor under these misconceptions, and this is what causes the unhappiness. So the reflection here, actually, before we do that, do you have questions or comments or anything that needs to be explained more about these four points? Can you see them happening? Can you recognize them? Yeah.
Looser?
Yes, you do have to like them looser. That's right, because actually what we find is that the more attachment we have, the less enjoyment. Because attachment, at first it's anticipation, but actually if we don't get the thing, then we can't bear the anticipation. We just want it to happen already. Then we get the thing, we get disappointed. We get too much of the thing, we can never have it again. We're over cherries or Dalmatis, like that's it. So all of that distorted, exaggerated up and down like a yo-yo, that's the mind of attachment, and that ruins our enjoyment of what's there. If we didn't have that, when we had cherries, yay. When we didn't have cherries, no problem. So it's a real irony. It's attachment that ruins our relationships. It's like jealousy ruins a relationship. So tight that you can't just enjoy what's there. Worrying that we're going to lose it can destroy a relationship when of course we're going to lose it because one of us is going to die first. Like, that's non-negotiable. Of course we're going to lose the relationship. But the worry, the tightness actually ruins it far quicker. So that is the great tragedy of it. Life is a tragicomedy, isn't it? So, I mean, many times we think, oh, get rid of attachment. And in our mind, well, I know I did, I heard get rid of fun. And then I go, no, can't I enjoy things? But actually, if we can release attachment, that distorted attitude, we'll just enjoy everything. I mean, it comes to mind, you know, when people get out of prison, they just walk out and they're just in the air and they can see the sky and they're happy. It's like, wow. But to us, we walk out our front door, we have the air and the sky and we just totally miss it. Yes. So I suppose the thing to recognize about this that the delusions just come when we have all three, the seed or the potential, the object, and then the distorted attention. And then the delusions and the suffering come. But if we remove that distortion, then we have the seed, positive things, the objects. Actually, then even someone who's yelling at you can be an object too for you to practice your patience. So you benefit from it. So actually the real key there is that inappropriate attention. We can start on that straight away. So let's just do just a really short reflection about attention. So again, just straighten your spine, bring your focus inwards, become aware of the rising and falling of the breath. And just become aware of whatever physical sensations you have without trying to change them, without trying to adjust them, just become aware. So if it's pleasant sitting in your seat, just noticing that. If your leg's gone to sleep and it's unpleasant, just noticing that without needing to do anything else, without needing to fix it, without needing to get more comfortable. Just notice and name. Notice the air temperature on your skin. If it's pleasant, notice it's pleasant without having to get more. If it's unpleasant, notice it's not particularly comfortable, but without having to fight it or change it. So just being aware of those physical sensations without exaggerating them, without judging as good or bad, without pushing them away or without grasping. And with this same method to notice and name, we can move on to emotions. Any emotional sensation that arises, notice and name and let it be. No need to possess. No need to defend or retaliate. You can gently bring your attention back. So one of the very profound, deceptively simple methods is to be able to just become aware of physical sensations, then emotional sensations without being reactive, just to practice a little space between the sensation and then how we respond. Which leads us to, what do we do? Okay, here's some real practical strategies. One is to do that reflection of that kind of bare awareness. And that means that we will become aware much quicker when we are suffering rumination. So notice when you're ruminating. So rumination is like going around like a cracked record, except can't say this anymore because there are no records. Oh, they're back again. That's right. Anyway, so that thing where we're going around and around, either, oh, they're not nice, I hate them, resentment, da, 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 and it's just getting deeper and deeper, or we're ruminating, it's anticipation. Oh, I can't wait. It's going to be fantastic. It's going to be great. So often that's self-perpetuating. And it becomes very difficult to just stop with willpower, especially if you're worrying. You can't actually stop it with willpower. So you've got to change your activities. And the way to do that is to actually physically move, stand up and go into another room or look at a view, physically change what you're doing. It makes a big, big difference. So if you physically change what you're doing, then it can help your mind to let go. What did you say to loosen the your? It was good anyway. Like it looser. That's right. That's right. So that one, especially because often we just notice something's wrong when we've been ruminating for a very long time and it's already got its own momentum up and you can't stop it. It's like your adrenaline's even going. You can't un-adrenalize. So that's where you just got to change the channel entirely and physically do something else. So going for a walk, changing the view, at least even going and sitting in a different chair will have a huge difference. Reframe the situation. So at least become aware, what colored glasses am I looking through the situation at? Okay, I'm in a pretty foul mood today. It's got to be those dark glasses. Oh, it's the blue ones. I'm feeling blue. You know, we're all doomed. There's no hope. Okay, so you're not dismissing your feelings, but you're recognizing that's a lens that you're looking through. And there is a different way that we can describe the world to ourselves. There are many different viewpoints. And even one of them, for instance, with feeling blue, with feeling down, instead of just, you know, feeling despondent with no self-confidence or feeling depressed, you can think, I am a budding Buddha undergoing depression. See, it made you smile straight away. Rather than I'm so depressed. So either... it's just words, but it changes everything. Reframing the situation can also happen if you look at the different variables. You just change one variable in the situation and everything changes. Recognizing those four misconceptions. See, try and spot them arising in your day-to-day life. And even if we can't remove those four misconceptions, just seeing, oh, that's what's happening, loosens their power. It gives us a little bit of space that can see it. There's a little bit of us that's not overwhelmed by them. Yes, so try and separate the pleasant from needing to possess the pleasant or the aversion from wanting to retaliate. So he's putting a little bit of space in there because they almost happen instantly. We like something, then we want it. So window shopping, for instance, is a great one because window shopping, you like it, you enjoy it, and you don't get it. It's a good practice. I would say also flirting is quite good, you know. Perhaps not in this, not appropriate in a Gompa, but anyway. and also aversion. So something is unpleasant, instead of just trying to get rid of it immediately, just relax for a moment. So I noticed that with, you know, sitting here cross-legged leading class, so my leg goes to sleep. It's not that I can amazingly sit here for an hour cross-legged like some brilliant meditator. No, I'm wriggling the whole time. But because I'm not focused on the pain in my leg, it's not a big problem. So it's just there and eventually I'll move my leg. But I have found if I'm actually just trying to meditate and I'm not leading a class, I'm just trying to meditate, then I'm much more distracted and I focus the pain in my leg. And then I have to move my leg or I'm going to die. So instead of just focusing on how you don't like it, don't want it, try and get rid of it, just go, oh, yeah, my leg's a bit sore. Oh, well, just a little looser and it takes that pressure off. It's huge, huge difference. Another way that you can separate this, you know, the pleasant from needing to possess it is by recognizing that those sensations, pleasant and unpleasant, are sensations. They're not the actual thing. It's not like, oh, that's so nice. It's like, oh, that's a nice sensation. And so it's easy to start with the emotional sensations. I mean, those physical sensations, then we go to the emotional ones. Because emotions, we tend to think they're true. There's a huge dramatic story to them, but actually they could just be an emotional sensation. And there's nothing true about them at all. Just think of a sugar rush. You know, at the time, we're like, woohoo, or coffee rush. You know, everything's great and wonderful, and then bam. So practice mindfulness of emotional sensations before reacting. So trying to remember, we don't need to fix something or repel something or grasp something. Just become aware of it and pause. So that's what mindfulness practices are about, is remembering to pause. And from this then leads on this is how we can actually relax, because there is nothing to chase after out there. That happiness and satisfaction isn't out there, so we can relax. There's nothing to defend. Someone's being aggressive to us or, told us that we're no good or that we did a mistake. Oh, I've got one here, Bruce. And it's okay. That's just words. Doesn't make any difference to us. So we can relax. That's the way that we can actually relax. Just telling yourself, relax. That's never worked. It also means that one of those misconceptions of thinking things will always stay the same, actually, if we remember things will change, that can help us relax, because those bad things will also change. Yeah, there it is again. But again, that noticing your mind being in the loop, that's the noticing and naming. And so then you're recognizing, yeah, it's a powerful loop, but it's not real. It's not what it's telling you is not true. They're not based on a real foundation. And even if for one moment they were true, they change.
Yeah. I'm starting to
not. Yeah.
I'm kind of increasing weird that much.
Yeah, so with the rumination, I notice myself. So then I go, okay, if I'm going to get obsessive thoughts, I'm going to make sure they're virtuous.
Yeah.
I'm going to have, if I've got all these words and conversations going through my mind, I'm going to make sure that they're positive ones and virtuous. You know, it's like the company that you keep in a way. Yep. Yeah, but just recognizing that you're doing it, which in itself is great to know that, at least if we can notice it's going on, that's half the battle right there. So expect change and disintegration. So I often say, in the kitchen, I am waiting for the day when something, there's the crash bang and something shatters, and then there's the big silence. And I'm waiting for the day where someone yells out, "Of course!" Every single cup and saucer and plate in the world is going to end up in pieces. That's it. There is no other possibility. Eventually, you can keep them in a cabinet and try not to use them ever. Or you could just see, if you know they're going to smash, that's their end point, then every day that you use them, it's a bonus. So expecting change and disintegration and breakage means we can relax and we can enjoy what we have. And when it breaks, then you go, well, I knew that was going to happen. And when the person dies, we go, well, I knew we were going to separate. So, yes, it's sad, but it's not destroying. Journal our assumptions. So what does that mean? That means that as beginners, I find it's actually better to write things down than to try and sit and meditate on them. The sitting and meditating on them can be really tricky if you're not already very good at meditating or good at analysis, because we either block things off or we end up ruminating, going off on this track, and we haven't come to a virtuous, positive frame of mind. So it's much easier to discipline our mind by writing it down and doing the analysis and then asking a question and then seeing what the answers are and then going and researching and looking up, what's the psychological view on this? So when you're worried about something, write down all the things that you're worried about. Then what are the assumptions that I've made? What are my expectations? And try and pin them down, and then you start seeing what's going on. It takes a lot of effort, but that's actually doing like a reflection meditation. Then if you sit down and do a meditation, it'll work. So I remember one time in Melbourne when I was going for a job interview, and I was terrified and I was in a panic for weeks and weeks beforehand. And then in the end, I just thought, I've got to get myself in hand here. So I wrote down everything that I was terrified about. So as you start writing it down, then you start thinking, oh, that's actually not that bad after all, or there's things that you can do to make sure it doesn't happen. And then in the end, it came to you, I was afraid of fear itself. I was afraid of the sensation of fear, of the unknown. That was my biggest fear. And once I recognized that, I was free. It was amazing. And it came from writing it down till I, you know, got it. Then in my notebook, it's like, right, right, right. Then it's like, OMG, I got it. Okay. Build your character and you will naturally become a good and happy person. So if we want to be good, if we want to be happy, it's not that we get happiness. If we want people to like us and think we're good, it's not that we make them respect us. We just got to build our character. We've got to become virtuous, safe people to be with. And then naturally everyone will like us, which is what we want. So it comes from the inside. So next week, what we're going to have a look at is what's called the three higher trainings, which is how to do this. That doesn't come naturally. There are some things that we need to train in. And this comes to your point, Lisa, that we can use our happiness as fuel for the inner work, for a meaningful life. So there's nothing wrong with being happy and enjoying things. And in fact, we need to. We need to enjoy our life. If we don't have joy in our life, it's very, very difficult to progress, to really pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. But mostly what happens when we're enjoying ourselves, we're having a good time, we just fritter it away. We're just very consumerist about it. Instead of using all of that good energy of a holiday, spending time with family, all of that positivity, encouragement, and then doing something with it. So it's, you know, when we have the happiness, we just consume it and then it's gone. But actually it is fuel. All the enjoyment that we have, we can use to benefit others. We can use to keep us going. All the enjoyment from the senses we can use on the path to enlightenment. And it's important that we do, because it's not sustainable otherwise. So we don't ever have to feel guilty about being happy or enjoying things, but we just got to do it with this realistic frame of mind, and then we'll really enjoy things. And then I think of all the lamas, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Geshe Zopa, like they laugh all the time, genuine. They're genuinely joyous. They'll be talking about things and they're jumping out of their seat with enthusiasm, you know. So where does that come from? They're not all dreary about it. And yet they're very aware of the sufferings in the world. Their whole purpose is to alleviate the sufferings in the world, yet they're full of joy. So that's actually what sustains us. So, you know, when good things happen, when you enjoy yourself, transform it into something that you can use. So it goes from just being a pleasant sensation to actually you can transform it into virtue and good qualities. Share it with others. Okay, so it's only inappropriate attention that delusions arise in the first place. We're mistaken. Those four misconceptions, they're mistakes. We're not broken. We're not evil. We're not fundamentally doomed. We're just laboring under mistakes, and that can be remedied. And true happiness comes from your capacity to experience joy. Not from the object out there. So during the week, there are the reflection sheets, again, on inappropriate attention. So the same kind of format. Have a read through every morning and see how you go. Notice if you're ruminating on things and change your activities. So just like Bruce was saying, that's number one thing. It changes everything, just becoming aware of it. And next week we'll look at the three higher trainings. So training in ethics, concentration and wisdom. With these three, we can completely overcome suffering. So let's dedicate our merits. Really appreciate your efforts of coming tonight and listening and contemplating and trying to relate it to your own life. Recognize this is an amazing investment in yourself as a human being. And it's an investment that will pay off with your own happiness and peace of mind, and also with being able to radiate that out, contribute to the happiness and peace of mind of everyone around you. And recognize if we can remove these distorted approaches of attachment and hatred, our life will become wonderful and joyous. Our problems won't destroy us, but will give us strength. So let's dedicate all of that, that we can ourselves become liberated completely from the cycle of suffering, and that we can bring everyone to a state of peace and happiness as well.